It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about President Obama's new call to protect net neutrality and the idea of a free and accessible internet.
First, according to psychological research, a lot of people overestimate their knowledge and abilities. And here's the weird part. The less people know, the more confident they are in expressing their opinions.
Here's an example cited by our next guest. It's from the Jimmy Kimmel Show's Lie Witness News segment. Here's the setup for this one. The show is asking people on the street what they had thought of this year's State of the Union address from President Obama. The twist is the day before he actually was going to deliver the address.
What did you think of President Obama's State of the Union address last night?
You know, it had different effects on different people. And you know, I just feel those effects affect everybody. You know, like you just got to stay positive. You got to not focus on the negative.
What did you think of President Obama's State of the Union address last night?
I thought it was powerful. I thought that he laid out a lot of the same sort of policies he's been laying out all along.
Did you notice that John Boehner kept falling asleep?
I did. I'm not sure if he was actually asleep or just resting his eyes, as they say. But yeah, it was not the best thing to see on national television. But there we go.
That was another answers. Maybe good for a laugh, but don't feel too smug because our next guest says all of us have moments just like that.
David Dunning joins us now. He's a professor of psychology at Cornell University. He studies accuracy and illusion in human judgment. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, staying with that Jimmy Kimmel segment, in a complete vacuum of information, why do so many of us try to come up with an intelligent answer?
Well, there are any number of reasons. Some people might just be bluffing because they want to look knowledgeable. but sometimes when you're watching the bit, you can't help but think that people actually think they have something reasonable to say, even though they're talking about events that never happened. So it can be we're trying to fool other people, but sometimes we fool ourselves by having information in our head that gives us enough to provide an answer, even to things that don't exist.
So that's a key to a lot of your research. Sometimes having some information doesn't necessarily lead to a better decision or solution than having no information.
Well, that's right. Sometimes, you know, the theories we have in our head, the facts, the figures we have in our head can mislead us in terms of what we think and what answers we provide, just as much as they lead us to the right answer.
Now, your research with a colleague led to what's been known as the Dunning, that's your name, the Dunning-Kruger effect, and that's getting a lot of attention, I find, when I started looking beyond your article. What is that?
Well, the Dunning-Kruger effect is the fact that incompetent people tend not to know that they're incompetent. That is, they tend to have very little insight into their deficits and into their shortcomings. Now, they may not be as confident as top performers, but they're not that much less confident than top performers, even though they're making a lot of mistakes and even though they're doing a lot of things that, let's say, diplomatically are suboptimal.
So what goes into that? You don't know anything about a topic, and so you feel fairly confident in your knowledge on the topic. Why?
Well, because I think the best way to think about the uninformed, and that's one way to think about who we're talking about, is that the uninformed aren't necessarily uninformed. That is, they don't have nothing in their head. They have something in their head. They have, you know, some facts, figures, ideas, hunches, rules of thumb that they think they can use to cobble up an answer. So that they're not uninformed, they're misinformed. That is, whatever they're using to come up with some sort of response, to solve some sort of problem, just turns out to be the wrong stuff. But it seems reasonable to them.
Are we hardwired to want to have an answer, whether or not it's the right answer?
It's hard to say. I don't know, it appears. And we do want to know the right answer, but also, if you take a look at the way the human organism is set up, we're also very good at spinning answers. We're very good at taking a few disparate ideas, then weaving together some sort of pleasing theory of how we should act, or some sort of notion of what's the best thing to do right now. And that's just a function of the fact that we were born to be storytellers. We were born to be theorizers. We were born to be pattern recognizers out in the world, which is the seat of a lot of our success, the source of a lot of our success. But at times, it's also the source of our undoing.
Now, how do you put this to the test in your research, this Dunning-Kruger effect, this overconfidence in our lack of knowledge?
Well, what we've done through the years, and now other people have done it as well, is we'll give people some sort of test, like a financial literacy or logical reasoning, or some sort of task, like watch college debate teams as they go through the preliminary rounds of a tournament, and just simply ask people how well they think they're doing, and we make sure that we find out how well they're actually doing. And what we discover is that people who are the poor performers tend to dramatically overestimate how well they're doing. So, for example, if a student has just taken an examination in a course, like a psychology course, and they're walking out of the room, we'll ask them, how well did they do? And usually they'll respond that they did well enough to get a B or maybe a B plus. When in fact, the test they just handed in just earned them a D or an F. And it's not the fact that people are faking. They're honest in their assessments. In fact, we'll even pay people up to $100 for honest assessments. But they actually really do think they're doing well in those circumstances where they're doing very poorly.
And I think another test, I don't remember if it was you or a colleague in the research profession, did things like put names of real-world political figures like Susan Rice next to made-up ones like Martin Meriwether and see how many people are familiar with those. What do you find when you do things like that?
That's right. We like to put people in situations where we know they know nothing about what we're talking about. And the way we do that is we ask them to tell us about fictitious or non-existent people, places, or concepts. So conversation about politics, we'll ask people what they know about Susan Rice, and she exists. She's in the Obama administration. But we'll also ask people about Michael Merrington, and he does not exist in Washington as far as we know. And what we find is people are willing to claim some sort of familiarity with Mr. Merrington, even though he doesn't exist. And the people who are willing to claim some knowledge are those who rate their expertise in politics the highest. So they're prone or vulnerable to making claims of knowledge they can't possibly have.
Now, when I hear about tests like that, or when I watch those Jimmy Kimmel Lie Witness news clips, my gut reaction is to think, yeah, haha, those people, they get things wrong. I'm above that sort of thing. How very wrong am I?
Well, our work and our thinking basically suggests to us that sooner or later, we will be those people. We will switch into their roles. That is, some of us are incompetent in important domains, and we're going to struggle and have trouble. But sooner or later, that fate is going to come to all of us. So sooner or later, each of us is going to be claiming knowledge or acting on knowledge we simply don't have.
Now, in some contexts, like if, somebody gets us on a camera thing like that, it's not a big deal. Does this have serious real-world consequences, do you think?
I think so. I mean, people do act on knowledge they think they have, even though they may not have it. So some recent data I came across were some data about 25,000 people in the United States and their financial habits. And in particular, whether or not they had declared bankruptcy in the last 2 years. And when I dove into the data, what I found is that the people who had filed for bankruptcy had financial literacy that was quite low relative to everybody else. But when you looked at their self-ratings of their financial knowledge, they rated themselves more positively than everybody else, suggesting that not having awareness of deficits in your financial knowledge might be a risk factor.
We're talking to psychology professor David Dunning of Cornell University, talking about why having limited knowledge can actually make us more confident in our opinions and our abilities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see this happening in your life, in your work? Have you ever tried to fake an answer rather than own up and say, I don't know? Have you ever confronted a closely held opinion or belief and realized that you'd been wrong all along? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with David Dunning, psychology professor at Cornell University. His recent piece called We're All Confident Idiots is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. His research looks at the ways we overestimate our knowledge and our abilities and finds that often the less we know, the more confident we are.
You can join the conversation with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Do you see this a lot, the notion of a confident idiot, someone maybe you work with who knows more or thinks they know more than they do, but doesn't quite get it right? Have you ever been in this awkward situation? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Cheryl on the line in Dousman. Cheryl, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I had an experience, a number of college courses in which you come together, or even professional development. I'm a public educator. And a lot of times there's some stress or tension in the area because we're talking about things and we're learning things. And if you're an educator, you're sometimes I think we're supposed to know everything. But when finally someone is brave enough to ask, wait a minute, I don't know what that is, what does that mean? It's like the stress in the room just finally releases and everyone can just be learners on an equal plane instead of having this pretense of, well, I already know this. And that feels good.
Cheryl, thank you so much. Interesting example. David, is this something that you've looked at? There's kind of a groupthink. Nobody wants to be the first one to own up and say they don't get it, even if everybody in the room might be in the same situation.
That's actually studied a little bit in social psychology, where we assume that the calm that everybody else exudes is knowledge when, in fact, they are calm because they don't know what else to do. When I run review sessions with students where they're asking questions, I often tell students right up front that they should ask questions, because if they have the question, at least 20% of the people in the room have the question, and an additional 40% of the people in the room should have that question, but they don't know it yet.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cheryl, at 800-642-1234. Another thing you get into in the piece we're talking about, David, is how we get a mistaken impression, a wrong belief in the first place. And you say that can come back to our very earliest years growing up, that we get this unquestioned assumption that sticks with us. Where does that come from?
Well, we're inveterate theorizers, we're pattern recognizers, and we, start that way way back all the way to birth. I mean, babies are trying to figure out what works, what can they control in the world, what controls them in the world. And they're coming up with theories and hypotheses and so forth about what works. And so they learn things like other human beings can move around the room, but not the computer on the desk. And so they're doing usually a good job of theorizing. But a one-year-old, a two-year-old is going to make some mistakes. And starting from those early years, we'll start to come up with theories that actually will turn out to be hard to shake, even in our adult years.
And talking about shaking theories, especially something that's closely held or a part of our own identity, how hard is it to change that, even when we're confronted with evidence to the contrary of what we think?
Oh, that can be very hard. And, people have cherished beliefs about themselves or cherished beliefs about how they think that the social order in the world should be. And, a lot is built up on those beliefs. And so if you question one of those beliefs, like, I'm a lovable and capable person, a lot else can come shattering down if you play with those beliefs. So those beliefs tend to be well defended. And if you're trying to change those beliefs from the outside, as an educator, for example, or maybe even in therapy, you have to be careful and you have to have some sort of technique to be able to successfully change beliefs that need changing without changing too much else.
Let's get back to our callers. We've got Mike on the line now in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hello, good evening, gentlemen. I was curious. I've got a 14-year-old daughter who does very well in school and very, very confident. And sometimes her confidence leads to her telling some stories now and then. And I don't know if it's stretching the truth or just what she believes to be truthful in her mind, and I'm curious how that relates to the topic.
Mike, thanks for the call. David, so is there a thin line sometimes between an exaggeration that we start to believe in and an intentional lie?
There can be. The interesting case, though, is when the person we're lying to turns out to be ourselves. That is, there are a few exaggerations that after a while become part of our belief system, become part of what we actually believe about ourselves. And sometimes that can be okay, but sometimes that can be a little dangerous. So often when thinking about yourself, it's good to have a little bit of a devil's advocate voice inside your head, actually question anything that you might, any belief that you might hold about yourself that you're unshakably confident about.
Can we train ourselves to have our own inner devil's advocate?
Well, that's the idea. I mean, there are certain habits of mind that people can develop, and everybody is going to have a different style. So, for example, I don't do this with every single decision because it would be too tiring. But when a decision is important enough and I think I know which way to go, I try to project myself into the future and ask, okay, let's say that I made that decision and it turned out to be an utter disaster. What got me to that disaster? What did I overlook? What went wrong? What was the assumption I shouldn't have made? And for myself, for important decisions, I found that to be very helpful in steering me away from decisions that might be a bit too rash. But it's something that I do only when the decision is important enough to expend that sort of energy.
What flavor of gum? Maybe you don't need to go through the process.
No, in fact, for flavors of gum, I say explore them all.
Excellent. Back to our callers now. We've got Irma on the line in Appleton. Irma, hi.
Hi there. And once again, I'm not sure if I'm going to be as eloquent as I want to be, but I come from the corporate world, and I think that the fundamental premise of what you mentioned is that more confident you are, less knowledge you may have in certain areas. Well, I'm just going to take a pragmatic situation where what I observe, and I don't know how true this is, but what I observe is that in the corporate world, where the motives may be a little different at times, depending who's in that meeting from a hierarchy perspective, what's observable is that that confidence, it becomes extremely important to persuade our senior leaders. And therefore, the whole politics of it kind of plays into that confidence. So basically the question is, how do we, there are more complex dynamics that happen
I think I got you, Irma. So sometimes you have to sell a point, play at being more confident than you want to be. So there's an incentive for this false sense of confidence, David.
Yes. I mean, there are situations when it's perfectly appropriate to be confident. That is, in a world in which people can be confident about the wrong idea, the right idea better have some confidence backing it if it's going to win the day. And I think the split between being cautious and confident is that at the moment when it comes time to energize, to persuade, I think, or to have your say, that's when you want to be confident. But you don't want to be too overly confident preparing for that moment. I mean, going through your arguments, doing your research, checking with other people, seeking out advice. There you might want to be potentially even overly cautious so that when the day comes, you are prepared and you have made the best case you can that you have the right idea. So I think confidence absolutely certainly does have its place, but I think it has to be a functioning partner with caution.
And briefly, in a group setting, corporation or otherwise, do we need to have a designated buzzkill to try to tamp down unwarranted confidence?
All I can say is that in medical schools and research labs that have been noted for their productivity and for their excellence, they tend to have such a person, or they have such a meeting where a person or a time is designated for the buzzkill, if you will. And it is a buzzkill. It is unpleasant, mm-hmm. and it can be tense. But what it does is it prevents a lot of buzzkill and tenseness that could happen later on. So that having a devil's advocate or having someone who's there to criticize, whose role is to criticize, I think actually is an important part of any group.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's psychology professor David Dunning of Cornell University. We have a link to his piece under the headline, "We Are All Confident Idiots," on the Central Time Facebook page.